You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com, bringing you the freshest radio in Brooklyn since 2009. Hear directly from chefs to farmers, artists to architects, authors to brewers, and everyone in between. Check out all of our shows on our website or by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. On behalf of everybody at HeritageRadioNetwork.com, we'd like to send a special thank you to the Hearst Ranch, our biggest supporter and longest-running sponsor since we first started in 2009. Hearst Ranch is the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. Since 1865, the Hearst family has raised cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of the Central California coast. The result is beef with extraordinary flavor that's as memorable and natural as the surrounding landscape. For more information, visit www.hearstranch.com.
Welcome to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Carmen DeVito.
I'm Alice Marcus Krieg.
And we are the principals of Groundworks, Inc. We design, build, and maintain gardens in and around New York City. Our show broadcasts from two shipping containers in Bushwick, Brooklyn, located next to Roberta's Pizza at 261 Moore Street. Now, on our last show, we discussed the quintessential summer fruit, Alice, the peach.
Peach. Sweet peach.
So today's show is all about my personal favorite summer vegetable, which is really a fruit or berry, botanically speaking, the tomato.
Tomato.
Anyway.
Let's call the whole thing off.
I grow my own tomatoes, and I wait all year long to eat them in summer because I won't buy them out of season. I'm very adamant about
right.
that. So I usually eat them right off the plant, or I use them in a lot of summer dishes. And most people look forward to that first tomato of summer, whether it's homegrown or, you know, from the farm stand. But there is one person that doesn't share my love of tomatoes, and that's my husband, Robin. And I told him we were going to talk about him today during the show. Those who know us well know that he is an omnivore in the truest sense of the word. He will eat anything.
Yeah.
And my family has given him opportunities to eat things that would give most people pause. Pig intestine kebabs, an assortment of internal organs, and something we call roasted lamb face, for lack of a better term.
Delish.
But he will not eat a raw tomato. He's repulsed. And I can't understand why. He's definitely in the minority, though, I think. Because for me, a tomato is like captured sunshine.
So he won't just pick a tomato
never.
And eat it right off the vine?
He will not. He will eat cooked tomatoes, and he doesn't drink, so we can't tempt him with the Bloody Marys that our guest Sarah Lohman brought.
Yeah.
But
is he an American?
He is an American, and he's married to an Italian, so there's something terribly wrong with the man who eats lamb face but won't eat a raw tomato. Anyway, they're so unique. They're tomato-y.
Sure.
They have that tomato taste, which is probably why he hates them. Now, I would venture to guess, and this is a very unscientific opinion because I didn't research it, that probably the tomato is the most commonly grown vegetable in people's gardens. Probably.
It absolutely is. I was actually reading a book, and Sarah can probably talk more about this. I was reading an early garden history, 1820 to 1850, and the tomato was in every single kitchen garden. But it was actually second or beyond the four main crops were corn, beans, squash, and onions.
Yeah, but probably today, tomatoes are probably, because you can grow them in...
I think it's also unavoidable, too. You plant one tomato plant, and if it does well, it just spits out tomato after tomato tomato.
Yeah.
There's no avoiding them.
Yeah. But, you know, the tomato didn't always have such a good reputation. In fact, for a long time, people like Robin, specifically Europeans, were very suspicious of and even reviled the tomato as poisonous and a product of the devil. Now, to understand why that happen, it helps to know a little bit of tomato botany. The tomato, Lycopersicon esculentum, also goes by a synonym, Solanum esculentum, is a member of the Solanaceae family,
right,
which includes the eggplants and potatoes, chili peppers, and even the common petunia. But it also includes some of the most deadly plants known to man, nightshade, mandrake, datura, and tobacco, which I also include in the potentially toxic plant category.
Right.
Now, tomatoes probably first came from Peru, I believe, and the wild tomatoes can still be found today in the Andes.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time the conquistadors came to Central and South America, there was widespread cultivation of tomatoes, though there's a lot of debate about where the tomatoes were first raised and exactly how they made their way into, you know, Mexico. But the Spanish explorers did think enough of the tomato to bring it back to Europe, where it was embraced long before Americans embraced them here. We were really resistant to it. But the Europeans admired it, admired the plant more for its beauty and not for its taste, because many people in Europe were hesitant to try it due to its similar appearance to its deadly cousins.
Mm-hmm.
It was very, very similar. Now, we have Joseph Piton de Tournefort to thank for giving us the tomato its botanical classification. In 1692, he placed tomatoes in this new grouping of plants within Solanaceae. It was a classification he called Lycopersicon, meaning wolf peach. And so that's not a name that's going to conjure up warm, fuzzy feelings, yeah. You know? This Greek,
I'd like a slice of wolf peach on my sandwich.
So, well, this Greek term appears to follow an old German word for tomato, which I'm not even going to try to pronounce. It's like wolf persic or something like that.
Persic something.
Anyway, that translates into English as wolf peach. But be that as it may, in this often repeated version, the name wolf perch referred to the tomato's round shape, reminiscent of a peach, while the wolf modifier derived from the Germanic folk belief that werewolves could be called up using other members of the Solanaceae family, such as nightshade and wolfbane. So at that time, only eggplant was familiar to Europeans in the 16th century. The others, like the tomato, came from the New World and were suspect.
Sure.
You know, they just weren't sure if it was good enough to eat. Now, the common name tomato I found really interesting derives from tomatl, its name in the Nahuatl language of the Aztec people. The English form tomate first appeared in the 17th century and was later modified to tomato, probably under the influence of the more familiar potato. Most of these early fruits were actually yellow and became known as manzanas in Spanish, mm-hmm. meaning apples, and pomidoro, apple of gold, in Italian. So, of course, just to seal the tomato's sinister fate, all parts of the plant, with the exception of the fruit, actually are poisonous. And perhaps to emphasize that exception, more recent botanists have backpedaled, adding esculentum, which means edible, to the beleaguered tomato's name to give us Lycopersicon esculentum, or edible wolf peach. Now, that's a mouthful. No wonder Robin doesn't want to eat it. It's an edible wolf peach. Unfortunately, this rearguard action came too late to redeem the tomato for our colonial forebears. Now, there's another theory why tomatoes got off to a rocky start in the U.S., and it also focuses on names. This time, the names involved are the earliest European ones, such as the Italian pomidoro, or the even more evocative French pomme d'amour, love apple. Such names, goes the theory, were hardly of the sort to make Puritans feel at ease with a tomato. A love apple or a golden apple, just too tempting for the Puritans to consider eating.
Right, right. It went from one extreme to the other.
Right. So, Alice, why don't you talk a little bit about how Americans finally did accept the tomato and, you know, started eating
right.
it. And
how the American public kind of embraced this wolf
eventually,
peach.
Wolf peach.
Well, according to the writings of Peter Hatch, who's the director of Monticello Gardens and Grounds in Virginia, Jefferson grew tomatoes, and his daughters and granddaughters used them in numerous recipes, including our famous American gumbo. The Jefferson women also pickled them and, in general, promoted their use in cooking. This claim is, of course, disputed by other authorities, such dispute apparently being the name of the game in tomato scholarship. In an article written in the year 2000, Hatch said that in an 1824 speech given to the Albemarle Agricultural Society, Jefferson's son-in-law, Thomas Mann Randolph, mentioned that enough tomatoes were hardly known 10 years prior. In 1824, everyone was growing and eating them.
So they accepted them pretty quickly.
Yeah,
into
that's a pretty big curve. or quick curve. Even if we lose the Jefferson as promoter of the tomato theory, there does appear to be a great number of anecdotes to choose from, all equally suspect, historically speaking, and entertaining. One is from the Colonel Robert Gibbon Johnson in 1830, who set out to eat a basket of tomatoes on the steps of the local courthouse, where a crowd collected to watch him foam at the mouth and twitch and generally carry on until he finally expired.
They fully expected him to die.
Yeah, yeah. But this is also, you know, vaudevillian, you know, entertainment.
Yeah.
So when he didn't, you know, the legend was changed and tomatoes were redeemed and gradually accepted as food, though preferably in a high processed form or probably in a cocktail.
Yes.
But back to the present. Since we've now overcome our fear of tomatoes, Americans, of course, have fallen in love with them. And burpees made a fortune off of them.
Yes.
The tomato, of course, is the state vegetable of New Jersey. I think everybody knows that.
Jersey tomatoes still can't get robbed to eat one.
That's right. And Arkansas has it both ways. The tomato is both the state fruit and the state vegetable. The USDA reports that each of us consumes close to 20 pounds of fresh tomatoes every year. And what's more American than Campbell's tomato soup? However, I have to share with our listeners that Carmen, being of Italian taste, has never had Campbell's tomato soup. And I can't get her in the middle of February to make a grilled cheese and dip it in tomato soup. She just won't do it. So
I have issues.
Yeah. Well, you know good tomatoes. You don't want processed tomatoes.
I can't do it. I'm sorry, Andy Warhol. Yeah.
So there is a funny website called tomatoesareevil.com. And on this website, you can shoot tomatoes and build evil-looking tomato people and have all kinds of tomato fun, juicy fun. So here are some fun tomato facts. Superstition once had it that placing ripe tomatoes on a mantle when first entering a new dwelling would guarantee future prosperity or would ward off evil spirits. So pin cushions, I think we've all seen those pin cushions, were in lieu of ripe tomatoes. And that's how pin cushions became red and that
shape. A tomato shape, yeah. I always wondered about that.
I did too. It's kind of an odd, but they're always that tomato.
Yeah.
Nurserymen also use tomato seedlings the way miners use canary birds. The seedlings cannot survive the smallest amounts of natural gas, so they're placed in greenhouses to warn of leaking gas heaters.
Mm.
So that's a pretty interesting.
You can put a tomato in your boiler room and see if there's any leaking gas. If the tomato dies.
Yeah. And according to the 1996 edition of the Guinness Book of Records, the largest tomato ever grown weighed in at 7 pounds, 12 ounces. Now, that's bigger than an average newborn baby.
Mm.
That's a big tomato.
Yeah.
Tomatoes are used in many food products, of course. Tomato sauce, tomato ketchup, pasta, and pizza. According to a Steel Packaging Council survey of 1997, 68% of chefs use canned tomatoes for convenience, quality, and flavor. There are many different recipes for tomato sauce, and every Italian family, of course, has their favorite. No two tomato sauces are identical. This is reflected in the Sicilian expression, "He is always different." Like a sauce.
Yeah, I can never make the same tomato sauce. I mean, I don't follow a recipe, but every time I make it, it comes out differently.
Say it in Italian.
Lui è sempre differente come la salsa.
And then in 1981, the USDA chairman declared ketchup to be a vegetable in order to justify the Ronald Reagan administration budget cuts in the school lunch program.
I remember that, and I was appalled. I was like, ketchup? Ketchup is not a vegetable?
Well, I found one final quote before the break, and then we're going to come back and talk with gastronomic historian Sarah Lohman to give us some recipes. And this is from Andy Rooney. The federal government has sponsored research that has produced a tomato that is perfect in every respect, except you can't eat it. We should make every effort to make sure this disease, often referred to as progress, that it doesn't spread. So
thank
plant
you.
Heirlooms.
Yes.
Now we're going to listen to Stereolab's Emperor Tomato Ketchup.
Stay tuned. We did plants.
Hi,
This is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Every Tuesday at noon, Dave Arnold, the author of CookingIssues.com, will discuss new and innovative techniques, equipment, and ingredients. Call in with your own questions to see if Dave and the crew can solve your cooking issues. Again, that's Tuesdays at noon on the Heritage Radio Network.
Hi, welcome back to We Dig Plants. Well, I had a mouthful of tomatoes. Sorry about that. Oh my God, Sarah, this is amazing.
Well, we are snacking on, I busted out during the break, some gazpacho, but it's not gazpacho how we really think of it today. So this gazpacho recipe comes from a relative of the Jeffersons, Mary Randolph. Uh-huh. And Mary Randolph wrote one of the very earliest American cookbooks, 1824. There are very few that predate her, and she's generally considered to be the first regional cookbook. I want to point out, too, that they're taking this time while I'm talking to stuff their mouths full.
Shh!
They're vigorously chewing while I'm talking.
I'm trying not to chew into the microphone.
So, what's interesting about her book is that it's also the first time a tomato recipe appeared in print. Mm-hmm. There's one that's been found earlier from a 1770 manuscript that's now you can get in a book form. But this is the first one. And not only that, it had 17 tomato recipes, which is kind of interesting, including... Yeah. The first recipe, not just in America, but ever known for gazpacho. They think that it came from a friend of Mary Randolph's that had spent some time living in Spain. Mm-hmm. Gazpacho has a history of being a peasant dish. So the historians think that's also why it hadn't been in print, that it just wasn't considered a high-end food.
It was a passed-down family recipe.
Family thing and something lower class. Original cookbooks were for courts, essentially, to make really fancy things. We don't think about it as rustic like this. So she, not having that kind of familiarity with it, she's thinking this is a really, really tasty dish. What's interesting about it is that the ingredients aren't pureed. In fact, I'll read the recipe for you. Gazpacho. It's labeled as Spanish, too. It says, put some soft biscuit or toasted bread in the bottom of a salad bowl. Put in a layer of sliced tomatoes with the skin taken off and one of sliced cucumbers sprinkled with pepper, salt, and chopped onion. Do this until the bowl is full. Stew some tomatoes quite soft. Strain the juice. Mix in some mustard, oil, and water and pour over it. Make it 2 hours before it is eaten. And that's all I did.
That's such a crazy... recipe from what I think of as gazpacho.
Yes, not only what you think of as gazpacho, but a lot of recipes that use fresh vegetables weren't really written down to the point where some people thought for a long time that colonial Americans were not eating salad. But the truth is, when you're eating fresh vegetables, you don't have a lot of recipes for fresh vegetables. You cook them.
You cut them up. Right.
So why would it be in a cookbook?
Right.
This is a little bit more complicated. And the only thing that's gazpacho-like is that you have this kind of mustard and oil you put over top, but it is very much like a modern salad in a lot of sense.
It's interesting too, though, with the biscuit, it's kind of reminding me a bit of lasagna.
It has a layer.
Yeah.
That's interesting too. So cold lasagna.
And with the carb, that like the layers of carbohydrates, like the lasagna noodles.
And I'm sure in Virginia, the tomato grew very, very well.
Yeah.
So they had a lot of tomatoes to deal with and to use.
To use up. And this is a great recipe for using up your tomatoes too. And I also have read, too, that the kind of use of tomatoes spread up from the South. So it's not surprising that the first place tomato recipes appeared were in the South. It seemed to go up from the Mississippi up into New England later, presumably originally from Mexico and Central America on up into the Americas. Mm-hmm. So that's the earliest gazpacho recipe, which 1824, who would have thought?
Right.
And it's really cool and really different, too, so I really enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
We're also snacking on some Bloody Marys, too.
Yeah.
So the Bloody Marys, now, I got to ask you, Carmen, because you're taking a swig there.
Mm.
These have a secret ingredient that is different than Bloody Marys as we think of today.
You want me to try to guess it?
Yeah. Yeah, and I'll give you a hint.
It's how good is your palate?
Very poor.
It uses
compared to some of the people on the station.
Yeah,
it does not use vodka. So, what is the alcohol that's in that Bloody Mary? Can you tell?
I think it's gin.
It is.
Yeah.
You are absolutely.
Which I actually like better.
Yes.
Yeah.
When I read that, I said, you know what? Vodka is such a neutral spirit. You put vodka in when you want alcohol in. You don't want to flavor anything else. I'm probably going to, get some trouble for saying this, but that's, for me, a reason why I don't like vodka. Vodka reminds me of being in college and,
pouring it down your throat.
Exactly. And mixing it with sherbet and fruit punch or whatever.
Yeah.
So, Jello.
In my mind, and I I challenge anyone to email me and vodka me differently. But in my mind, it's an alcohol about getting drunk, not enjoying getting drunk. Right. How about that?
This is really good.
Thank you.
Really good with gin. Now, I would have never thought to.
Isn't that amazing? And to be honest, I wanted to get a Hendrix gin because I think that the cucumber notes in Hendrix would be really nice pairing with tomato.
That's right. Right.
So this is just a London dry gin, which is very good. But I would love to try this again with Hendrix.
Now, do you have a date for this recipe?
I do. So they think that it's as a lot of things, a lot of very, very important moments in culinary history are often shrouded in myth. And it's all about deciphering which myth is the least false.
Right.
So we do believe that this was invented by a man who was the bartender at the St. Regis. His name is Ferdinand Pitouard. So he was originally a bartender in France, where he claims he added vodka to tomato juice. After Prohibition, he was working in France in the 1920s, 19-teens, comes over here after Prohibition, works at the St. Regis, adapts his drink, probably using a tomato cocktail that was on the market here that had Tabasco, Worcestershire sauce in it, and salt and pepper as well. Mm-hmm. But vodka wasn't available in the United States yet in the 1920s and 30s.
When you said that, I was wondering when that happened. Want to start talking about
it. Really
spirits.
Happened mid-century. And we have a love affair with vodka in this country now, but it really doesn't start appearing regularly until the 1950s and 60s. So he tried gin. And it was originally called the Red Snapper, which I think is also
nice.
a great name.
I like that better, though.
Yeah, the Red Snapper. So maybe that we should give that title and bring back the gin Bloody Mary as the Red Snapper. And other than that, it's a very classic recipe with lemon juice, tomato. I actually used a strained tomato puree that I found in a carton in my grocery store. Mm-hmm. But a great way to use up that abundance of tomatoes that you will get in the next month is to make tomato juice yourself. Mm-hmm. You'll probably get a slightly thicker product. Mm-hmm. But just add a little bit of water, you know, to just loosen it up a little bit. And you can do that by just peeling tomatoes, stewing them, mashing them, putting them through a strainer, putting them through a food mill. It'll make, particularly from your garden cup of sunshine tomatoes, a really beautiful, flavorful drink. So we're really tomatoing it up here. And I have to say, Carmen, if you don't like tomato, if you won't drink or eat canned tomato soup, which I have to admit, I don't really like either. There is a great recipe for tomato soup cake in MFK Fisher's book, How to Cook a Wolf, which is her most famous, important cookbook.
How to Cook a Wolf Peach.
How to Cook a Wolf Peach. Perfect. She's got a recipe for tomato soup cake, and I made it because
it
I was
good.
Curious. It was really good. It's actually vegan, too, because the tomato soup replaces the milk and the eggs. You don't put any butter in it. I had a dinner party and made my guest the secret ingredient. No one got it. So it's a really rich spice cake that adds a really wonderful undertone.
That's a great way to use up the tomatoes. Speaking of which, I have something to taste.
Ooh.
As well. The tomato in its pure form from my garden.
Ah.
What kind of tomato is this, Carmen?
There's two types. There's Matt's Wild Cherry, which is the small red one. Oh. And then there's one of my favorites, which is Sun Gold.
Oh, they're beautiful. Oh, the little cherry ones are adorable.
These are really tiny. They're kind of wild. They're so small.
Yeah.
And these were originally grown by a local grower. Mm. But Sun Gold is one of my favorite cherry tomatoes.
Sun Gold is amazing.
It's like sugar. Mm.
Mm-hmm. These kind of tomatoes are the ones that had me hop the tomato fence.
Yeah.
Growing up, really, you too?
Yeah.
Growing up, I feel like all I had access to was the hot house, you know, just mealy, tasteless, everything just terrible about them tomato. And so I grew up thinking I did not like ripe, fresh tomatoes.
Mm-hmm.
And then I came to New York. I started getting the CSA. I get this bucket load of tomatoes. And
that's
I'm like,
awesome.
All right, we got to make peace with these.
Yeah.
And now I really, really enjoy fresh tomatoes.
They're
the
like
flavor,
candy.
They're so delicious. Tomato flavor isn't present in a lot of grocery store tomatoes. And
Well, there's actually a new book coming out kind of demystifying this whole industry. Mm. Right, Carmen? You were just talking about it.
Yeah, it was on our competitor, NPR.
Mm.
They're going to buy us one day. They need our programming.
I've never heard of that.
Jack.
Actually, it's about the sinister tomato industry and the, you know, the immigrant labor in Florida. Mm. And it's a very interesting book.
And it's just coming out, right?
Yeah.
So,
mm-hmm.
Maybe we could get the author on.
Well, look, I live on a fourth floor walk up in Queens, but I got one of those topsy-turvy tomato planters.
They're incredible.
Did it work?
Awesome.
Did it work?
It totally worked. Now, I didn't have enough light, so I got maybe 15 tomatoes off of it, but they were the best tasting 15 tomatoes I've ever had in my life.
Oh, so. Yeah. I have, on my fire escape, I've got three cherry tomato plants. And, you know, my fire escape, between us not watering it, you know, forgetting, because we have to climb over bicycles and then out a window and, you know, it's Brooklyn living. When we do go out there, though, to water, the reward is that you get to have one cherry tomato, you know, that the squirrel hasn't gotten.
Right.
So
yeah, we are competing with the other
so
critters.
Yeah, but they are just delicious. And you just don't, you can't buy that taste.
No.
You know?
I mean,
or if you can
someday.
Buy it, you have to pay a lot of money. You have to go to Italy.
You got to scour the, of course, the green markets and
but
CSAs.
But even still,
are great
well,
too.
That's what I'm saying. Like, if it's farm grown, you know, that then you're going to get it.
Yeah.
But that right off the vine, that musky.
I've never tasted anything like it.
Yeah. And when you're buying the tomato, it's not like a fruit that you can kind of sniff it and see.
It's
you
not
know,
like a peach
it,
or.
Yeah. You can,
you
know,
just cut into it and it's a disappointment.
Yeah. I've had a lot of tomato-y disappointments.
So I, you know, I understand your husband. I was very much on the same page. I think it's
really?
The tomato-y disappointments, the watery, the acidity. Like thinking about a bad tomato, I just hate it. But
he hates the slime. It's
the
slime factor.
Oh my
horrible.
God! But when the slime meets when the slime meets with mayonnaise on white bread, and some salt, like what better
or bacon?
Yeah,
what?
Come on,
yeah,
you know
what better sandwich is?
I had a life changing BLT the other day. I went to Rye House, which is off of Union Square, and they have a fried green tomato BLT with spicy mayo, and it was probably the best sandwich I've had in my entire life.
That
is
sounds
that,
good.
Where is it again?
Yeah, Rye House is on East 17th Street, so they're getting a free plug right now. I went there the other day. It's a great cocktail bar. And that they've got an extensive bourbon collection if you like that. And their BLTs on rye, they're breaded fried green tomatoes, big thick slices of bacon and spicy
mayonnaise.
That sounds
perfect.
It was awesome.
I think I'm going to head there right now.
It was awesome. So I've been changed as far as tomatoes go.
Yeah. Good.
Well, Robin, this is for you. You can convert. There's still time. There's still time.
Yeah. Tomatoes grow every year. We're going to keep working on you.
That's right.
Well, thanks, everyone, for listening. You've been listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. Sarah, any final words before?
Yeah, I get to plug something.
Yes. Do,
I do. On August 11th, which is a Thursday at 8:30 p.m., NYC TV is premiering their series Appetite City, which is an 8-part miniseries based on the book by William Grimes. The show is hosted by William Grimes, but features Sarah Lohman.
Yay!
Believe it or not.
Yeah.
Every single episode, there's 8 episodes. You're going to cut to my kitchen in Long Island City, and we're going to cook a recipe on that particular episode's theme. A historic recipe on the theme of
awesome.
The show. So I eat everything from pickled oysters to pig's feet to one of the best things I've ever had, an apple pancake from Reuben's Deli. So tune in. That's August 11th at 8:30 and every Thursday after that. And
good.
The episodes will be available online at WNYTV.gov.
Oh, I can't wait.
I can't wait to watch.
I can't wait for that.
Yay, thank you.
So Sarah's blog is four pounds flour.
That's right.
.com. Mm-hmm. It's really a fun blog, and you also do a lot of events.
I do a lot of events. If you'd like the recipes for today's show, just log on my blog. I'm going out drinking the rest of the afternoon, so maybe check in tomorrow. I'll be honest. I teach classes with the Brooklyn Brainery, which is where I'm headed right now. I'm headed to the City Reliquary. They're throwing a big party to celebrate the summer. Brooklyn Brainery has cheap classes about everything.
Right.
So I'm doing an ice cream making class in a couple weeks there, so check out their website as well. And this fall, I'm going to do several events with the Brooklyn Historical Society, too, including on October 20th as part of Cider Week. We're going to do an apple-based alcohol event.
Well, I'm there.
Yeah. Four cocktails. We're going to feature local producers. We want to bring back apple alcohol in the state, which would mean a lot to farmers' economy here, too. So it's a little bit of advocacy event.
The Big Apple.
I know. So it's been passé, and now it's time to revive it. Prohibition killed it. We're bringing back a lot of other things. So cider and apple
I love
cider, and a lot of people laugh at me when I order cider
at a
bar.
It's like a girly drink.
They're like,
delicious.
Oh my god, why don't you just get a beer? I'm like, no, I actually really like it.
Yeah. So so come, bring the haters, and we're gonna make some real cocktails.
You need Steve Buscemi.
Steve Buscemi. Oh, I'll get him on the phone.
From Boardwalk Empire.
Oh yeah,
you know that would be great.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'm doing a bunch of events with them. Just look on my blog, and I'll be posting fall event schedule very soon.
Good. Thanks for listening. We dig plants on the Heritage Radio Network. If you'd like to listen, you can tune in to iTunes, free podcast, or check out the website archive. Happy gardening.
See you in the garden.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.
Figure on the Pulse and City Winery are proud to present the Summer Barbecue Blowout Festival, August 6th, from noon to 4 p.m. The barbecue is happening at City Winery, located at 155 Varick Street in New York City. Restaurants featured at this event are Empire Mayonnaise, Van Dag, Momofuku Milk Bar, Imperial No. 9, Mile End, Mexico, Kraft, Dizzy's Club, Coca-Cola, The Meatball Shop, and Dos Toros. Providing the soundtrack for the day are Midnight Magic, Computer Magic, New Villager, Punches, Ducky, DJ Autobot, and the Snacky Tune DJ. VIP and general admission tickets are available at citywinery.com. Finger on the Pulse of City Winery, we'd like to thank our sponsors, Heritage Foods USA, New York Magazine, Reka Vodka, Sonar, Smile, Guilt City, Sub-Zero, and Wolf. Please come out and join us for a day of fun, food, and dancing. For more information, go to www.fotpnyc.com.